Welcome to the Abram & Abram Podcast, episode 66, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry.
This episode, we talk about OddCamp and the groups we attend and organise.
We have a general discussion about IT education.
And we also talk about making a Linux-based boot image. I thought we'd start things off this week by talking about congregating a group of people, not too dissimilar to talking on a podcast. So I run a user group, and I run that session once a month. And it was basically because where I used to live, in sort of relatively close to Manchester, I used to get into Manchester every month and meet up with people talking about sort of front-end web development and sort of back-end web development. I was a member of the Linux user group and things like that. And when I moved out of city centre into a sort of slightly more rural area, I found it quite difficult to have that regular conversation with people that were working in IT that wasn't kind of directly related to customers and work that we were doing on a day-to-day basis. So I set up a user group in the area where I live, which is Glossop, called Sociable Tech. And whereas, obviously, in a larger city, you can get away with being quite a niche group. So you can sort of say, oh, this is going to be talking about, you know, Linux, or this is going to be talking about free software, or it's going to be talking about PHP or something like that. In a less niche area, I've gone for the big guns and basically gone for anything that is related to digital or IT industries. And I thought if I was to talk about it a little bit about how I've set this group up and sort of compare it to things that you guys might potentially attend and go to. Mm. I don't know whether that's interesting or useful.
Yeah.
So do you guys attend anything at the moment?
I go to, it's kind of big city scenario, but I go to a group of freelancers called The Farm in Brighton. Mm-hmm. But that's obviously based around, you know, freelance work generally in tech. It doesn't have to be, it's just got a general freelancer theme, but obviously a lot of the freelancers are techies. So I went there initially, you know, to look for work, you know, basically a sideline. But as it turned out, there wasn't really much work for me when I first turned up. And so I just got to know the people there and, you know, we talk about tech sometimes, we'll talk about non-tech sometimes, but it's a week, it goes on every week, almost right, without fail. So there's not the same people every week. It can be loads of people there one week, and it can be like 10 people there the next week.
And is that an evening thing, or is that a...
Yeah, it's definitely a pub-based thing. Much beer gets drunk usually, and much talk ensues. So, yeah, I mean, I think probably the one thing about it is it's quite... there's a lot of blokes there, which is probably a general tech thing.
Mm.
So a non-bloke coming along might be a bit like, oh, there's loads of blokes here. but other than that, yeah, I'm a bloke, so it's cool.
So how about you, Al? Do you go to anything?
Not on a regular basis, no, because kind of where I live is like, you can either go to Norwich, which there isn't really much. It's all quite bespoke. I think there might be some user groups, which is like for programming and stuff, but nothing as in what my day job is as in sysadmin or infrastructure. I mean, I'm a member of the, well, I've been on the mailing list for the local LUG, the Anglia Linux user group. I think they meet up once a month, but I never managed to actually get there. But apparently it's like on the second to Thursday of every month, but I've never been there. And it's interesting, I get the daily digest from the LUG, and I get like once every couple of weeks or whatever when something, but the people on there are never the people locally, which is really odd. I don't understand why that is. I don't know, you may be like, people ask stuff which you think actually you could probably Google that and get a better answer than asking on a...
I suppose it's a real world example though, isn't it? It's like, what have you tried kind of thing, because yeah, you can Google it and you can get lots of answers that you can try, but unless you've actually passed that information on.
And I mean, some of the people who reply, they like reply with like companies they work for, obviously for themselves, but they're not local to Norfolk kind of thing. So that's just really odd.
So there's a couple of bits with that. So one of the things that I've found around here is not so much around the technology side of things, but the Facebook groups for the area. Again, you get people saying, you know, things like, does anyone know when such and such a road is due to be reopening? Or, you know, can anyone suggest a pub to go and drink out on that's going to be watching the football? And it's the sort of thing, again, where you could, you know, pick up the phone and phone the pub, or you could go and have a look and see what's on the signpost, or you could, like you said, just Google for, you know, opening times for the pub or something like that. And people tend to, like Jerry said, you know, they'll ask someone to get feedback from the community rather than necessarily just... Because some people just don't know how to search.
It's about the community, isn't it? It's about having an actual community of people. And it could be online, or it could be someone that you just you meet in the pub every so often. But it's still good to have someone's personal opinion rather than a load of opinions that you've then got to sort through and make sense of.
But the other thing is, for me, so part of it is as well that it's very easy for us as experienced technical people to say just Google for something, but actually not everyone can think of what the right terminology is to search for something.
They haven't got the right amount of Google foo.
Well, it's not even so much that. I mean, there was an article that I read a little while ago basically saying, you know, stop with telling people to RTFM.
I mean, that really annoyed me in my early days of 10-15 years ago. It's like, that's great, you know, but you could just tell me or direct me to the relevant part of the documentation even.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it is sort of the trying to encourage people to realise that actually, if your documentation is always talking about, say, for example, widgets, and you're saying, but I'm not sure, I don't know how to ask about widgets, I only know about this thing that I'm looking at right here, you might not be able to translate the terminology that you know, which is, you know, a cog, a magnifying glass, into a, you know, that's a settings button or that's a enhance icon or whatever it might be.
Also, the nature of open source stuff is it's constantly in flux anyway, so you know, read the manual, or the manual might have changed in the last week or so.
Yes.
Or you yourself, if you could see a way around it and make an improvement to the software and rewrite the manual, even potentially.
Absolutely, yeah. But so the other thing that I was going to say was that obviously Al mentioned that a lot of the people that communicate on the LUG mailing list are not necessarily local people. Going back to the user group that I've set up, I'd say a good two or three of the members that come from at least sort of 45 minutes away from where we run the group from. And part of the reason for that is that it's talking about stuff that is appropriate to them where they are. So while it might not necessarily be a local group or even tentatively local, some people are willing to travel, you know, hundreds of miles in some cases to go to a group of people that meet their targeted needs, whatever those needs might be.
I should say, saying that, I've just been re-watching The League of Gentlemen on iPlayer, and it made me think of a local LUG for local people.
Okay, just as a random factoid that isn't really that interesting but might be a little bit, is that actually where Social Tech, the group that I run, meets, is actually they meet in the town that they filmed all of the outdoor broadcast or all the outdoor stuff for the League of Gentlemen.
It's not the job centre, is it?
The job centre actually got knocked down about 6 or 7 years ago, but the church is still there. What they had as the town hall, that's... Anyway, we're well and truly off topic. But yeah, my eldest's birthday party was held in the venue that they used as the town hall in the...
Right.
Anyway.
A local town hall for local people.
A local town hall for town... Yes. But yeah, so sociable tech. So as I said, I used to go to stuff in Manchester. And the main group that I went to that I got a lot of influence from was a group called Geek Up. But one of the people I was talking to about Geek Up said that they didn't like the fact that it was A, called geek, because geek can have quite a negative implication, which is part of the reason why I went for tech rather than geek. And the other thing that they said was they didn't like the fact that it was in a pub. So I made sure that the venue we were using was not a pub. And we've had 6 meetings now in a not a pub venue, and the numbers are not anywhere near what I would hope to have. So we're actually about to change the venue from being in a what is actually an art centre to being in a pub, although I haven't yet picked which pub of about 3, because Glossop's quite a good town for pubs, but I haven't picked which one yet is going to be the one that we're going to move to. But because of the fact we were in a smaller venue to start with, we actually used Eventbrite to get tickets, even though they were free tickets, just to sort of try and gauge numbers to make sure we weren't going over our available space and size limit. And I don't know whether that necessarily put people off sort of coming to the sessions or not.
I suppose if it's in a pub, well, it depends if you're in a function room in a pub or just downstairs in a pub. But, you know, if it's just in a pub, you know, more people might come along, or the people that don't like it being in a pub might not come along. But, you know, I suppose maybe you could have some kind of not in a pub event every once in a while or something.
Part of the reason as well was that I was kind of keen on sort of making it into a almost like a bit of an extension of this, where it's, you know, talking about things that are interesting to me as an admin and a geek in my case, and, you know, and maybe being able to help people that weren't necessarily on the same path but wanted to take a similar path and stuff like that.
Yeah, because where I am in Norwich, for saying, is there's a couple, I know it's like a little lug thing, but there is, I know there's like a thing for like more admin developers, where they're trying to get people to do the developing kind of thing, they call it development work. And the same with Cambridge, it's all about like Python, Internet of Things. Obviously, Cambridge is quite, there's nothing really round my kind of way, which I think, I mean, I know like in London, in Manchester, they do like VMware things. They, And I've seen that in Azure stuff, and I think it might be Birmingham, they do a monthly thing about Office 365, which I'd really like to go to, but it's just a bit too far for me to go.
I was going to say about the developer thing, the farm that I mentioned, the Brighton Farm thing, that was very sort of web developer heavy. Well, it still is really, but I just had more conversations. Like there was a Drupal developer that got into Ansible, and I was talking to her about Ansible. It's just quite an interesting cross-pollination there, because like she was even consulting doing Ansible stuff just because she started using it for her Drupal stuff. So there is that kind of crossover there, especially, I hesitate to call it DevOps, but it's people are becoming more aware of, you know, certain types of the admin side of stuff, just as admins are becoming more aware of developers. I think even if it's not quite right for you, you can still sort of meet people, and you're generally in the kind of tech area, so there's always a sort of conversation to be had there. I mean, for me, that was the group that I found, so I kind of talked to them about stuff that I do and vice versa.
Obviously, one of the things that we have as admin podcast is a Telegram channel. Maybe if some of the people that listen to this want to tell us about the sort of the groups that they go to, and maybe we can sort of, you know, plug some of those if it's appropriate to the show. So if you want to come into a Telegram channel, which we'll give you some details about a bit later on, you know, and tell us a little bit more about, you know, the groups that you go to and sort of how often they meet. Maybe that's a...
If you put it on the Telegram channel, there might be someone else quite near to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or a like-minded person, they start your own group.
So how many have you done so far? 6 or so?
Yeah, so we started in January. The first session, a little bit embarrassing, because I said, you know, I had a canned talk about how the internet works, which if anyone's seen my talks at Ogcamp...
About encryption.
No, not about encryption. We will never mention that subject again. I was talking about sort of how, you know, basics of how the internet work, and I sort of said, you know, does everyone know roughly how the internet works? And everyone went, well, yeah, obviously. I was like, oh, okay, it's that kind of session then, is it? Okay, let's just have a round table then, shall we? But the next one we did was about GDPR. And actually, we had a lot of people come into that, because obviously that was in, was that March? Yeah, that was March. And it was, obviously people were in the starting run-up of, oh my God, GDPR's going to, you know, take my firstborn child and everything else.
It's the new millennium bug.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, so that was that. And then the other sessions we've had about, I did one session about Git. And
how did you get people to come along? How did you advertise it?
That is interesting. So I was still on the mailing list for the handful of Northwest UK tech groups. So I spammed them, and I spammed all of the local Facebook groups, and I set up a Twitter account.
I should say that I've come off Facebook as a result of the GDPR thing.
You've come off Facebook.
Well, I've still got my account, but I haven't got the app on my phone, and I haven't gone to it in the browser since May the 25th, because there was something that you had to agree to for GDPR, which I didn't. I thought, right, no, that's a good cut off, and so I haven't been on Facebook since.
Oh, right.
Which, you know, might be cutting off my nose to spite my face, but I still use WhatsApp actually, because I think that's a bit of a good compromise to use their infrastructure, and they can know where I am and whatever, but they can't actually read my messages. Mathematically speaking, I think they've got all my metadata, but they haven't got the actual content of my messages. And I also use Signal as well. So, but anyway, we're getting off topic.
The one thing that I meant to do and never really did, or haven't done yet rather, was actually put up like flyers, sort of advertising the group, which I probably should do, to be honest, because Glossop has basically a town square with shops along it, so I could probably get away with putting stuff along there. I just haven't done that yet.
Are there other flyers? Are there like flyers for clubs and stuff like that? Or
the main one that I see is Slimming World. Probably not quite the same thing, but no. You know.
Yeah, I mean, the only place I've seen flyers is Brighton, so it's probably slightly different to Glossop, and 20 years ago, or 10, 15 years ago.
Mm.
I don't even know if they use flyers anymore. It's probably all social media campaigns, Instagram, Snapchat and all that.
Yeah. I did set up stuff on LinkedIn as well, because I figured that was more likely to be an in than anything else, but that's had absolutely no take up whatsoever. So I'm probably just posting it all in the wrong way or something.
That's interesting, actually, because the thing I was going to say about meetups and so on is working in London, I've had been to a few meetups in London, but they're mostly run by recruiters or recruitment agencies. So it's in their interest to get people kind of talking to each other. So
that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it from that perspective.
They're the people that organise it and probably sponsor it. And there's generally beer and pizza, and there's some really good talks. But it tends to be the, you know, get there, have a few beers, go and see a talk, have a few more beers, go and see another talk, and then it's over. And it's quite a different way of, it's a lot more kind of, I don't know, a production line, it seems. But good talks in the middle of it.
We had some as well before. It was like an IT manager, and it's like reorganized by MSP locally. So it's all about basically selling their services.
But like, I mean, there can be, as well as, you know, getting work or, you know, whatever networking, they can still be good for just people saying what they've done, you know, a bit like, you know, something like a talk at OddCamp, but in that context, that can be good, but you've got to know kind of what you're going into. And it's not like, it's probably not something that, you know, an enthusiast would go to. You know, I hesitate to use the word, but amateur, you know, so a non-professional would turn up to, but everyone's welcome kind of thing. Again, it's just a case of Eventbrite or whatever, and reserving your place. I think it's actually Meetup. Is it meetup.com?
The problem that I found with meetup.com is that it's very expensive. It's quite an expensive product to use, which is a bit disappointing because they're very much geared up to sell tickets and for the tickets to be a paid thing. And so to actually use the facilities of the group, you're looking at like almost sort of £30 to £50 per session from memory. So yeah, it was quite expensive, which for, you know, a group you're just kicking off and getting started, it seemed quite an expense, almost too far really.
Yeah.
So also, have you guys played with Scratch most a lot at all? I've played with it for the first time today with the kids. My 7-year-old came home this week with he's been doing Scratch Junior on an iPad, so I've installed it. And I remember speaking to someone about it, or they were doing it at an Og Camp a couple of years ago. The first one I went to, there's a stand with it on. So yeah, I basically went to the library today to get a book on it, and we wrote our first little program. And I'm really impressed with how it worked and how easily my little son picked it up.
So I've used it a bit. Daniel and I played with it, and it was effectively, we were just using it like Logo, to be honest with you, if you remember Logo, the programming language. Yeah. Which was just more sort of, you know, move the sprite to this location, put the pen down, go forwards 10 steps, turn 10 steps, turn 10 steps, and, you know, do circles, and then kind of iterate on that. But we never really did an awful lot with it about, you know, because you can do quite a lot around, you know, changing the background and, you know, seeing if you're near the edge of the, if you touch the wall, or see if you touched another character or anything like that. And we've not done anything along that. And like you said, my son came home from school saying, we've just used Scratch Junior.
The time when my kids were doing that, that's pretty good 5 years ago or so. So things probably changed a lot since then. But I think when I first heard about it, it was something that you installed. It was like something that you could install. But then when my daughter came home and I looked at it online, and it was an online thing where you just sort of did the stuff online. So I don't know what it's like now.
I think it comes with a Raspberry Pi. I literally just went app, get install, scratched it, downloaded it.
So my experience is that there's two versions. You've got Scratch for Flash. Oh, no, not, it was Flash. It's like a JavaScript-based thing, which runs in a browser. And if you run that from scratch.org, is it scratch.org? Scratch.mit.org. Anyway, something like that. There's a website for it. If you search Scratch, it's the first one that comes back. If you run it through the browser, it works, and it's got a lot of assets in it. If you install Scratch, either through a Raspberry Pi, in Windows or Mac or Linux or anything like that, you don't get as many assets.
Yeah, so I was just saying, if anyone else had played it, I was quite interested and quite surprised how well he picked it up. So, I mean, when I was at school, no one was doing it. It was like spreadsheets or whatever. And they had Basic on the BBC and whatever, but no one was there to teach you.
Well, I mean, I think this is part of the thing. I don't know how it came in when it was about 5 years ago. It was about the time of the first Og Camp I went to, which was, I think it was 2014. So that, I think, yeah, it was about, yeah, four, so 4 years ago. That was when, I think it went into the national curriculum. So by now, teachers, if they've been doing it for 5 years, have probably picked up some more of it. So I'd be quite interested to know if that's the case, or whether teachers have never done it before and are teaching it.
It's interesting. So I don't know what Al's experiences with it are, but my experiences with junior school teachers is that they're aware of the fact it's on the curriculum, but it competes with so much other stuff, particularly around things like maths and English, that arguably are more important to a certain extent, particularly at this point in their life.
Yeah, well, Oscar's teacher, he's very maths orientated. He's like the maths person for the school, so very maths thing. And this, we went to like a teacher day, or like a go in and see what they're doing. And they teach maths completely different than when we went to school. So, but they seem to be quite good. I mean, I just wanted to teach Oscar because I know that I find it useful, and it's actually quite good for me to learning about variables and everything and learning in these. And I think if you get them young enough, I never got a chance, and that's why I think I struggled a bit because I didn't have no one to teach me what those things were.
I should say that talking about logo, that was the one thing when I was, because they were flailing about a bit when I was young. So that this, we're talking mid-80s when I was that sort of age, and this was just when you know, sort of Spectrum, BBC Micro was the big thing, and so everyone was struggling to learn BASIC. You know, sort of teachers were struggling to learn BASIC and teach this to primary school kids. And logo was quite an easy thing to learn, and you had immediate visual feedback from it. So I think that's why it sort of captured my imagination. I never got into coding, actual text, you know, text editor. It took me another, 30 years or something to start using a text editor properly.
So I was quite fortunate in that my parents saw that I had an interest in computers. My mum was a teacher, so she was learning about the BBC Bees because they'd come out around about that same time. So we actually ended up buying a BBC Bee. And I think the key thing at schools at the time was that they was basically had a load of education games that they would get. They would give children to play, but they wouldn't particularly get them to program. What you more found was the kids that were interested in programming were sort of found the manuals for the computers and were doing, you know, 10 print Hello World or whatever, or, you know, more likely 10 print something rude. 20
print, go to 10.
Go to 10, yeah. Or 10 print John is cool, which obviously I would never have sent. 20 go to 10, you know, that sort of programming you wouldn't tended to have got in a classroom, you know, multi-line programming. And I think what I've found particularly with Daniel is that really, while he can kind of get the idea of, you know, forward 5 and turn 30 and everything else, he doesn't really get the whole, why would you have a variable? How do you use that variable in programming?
I should say, I only really learned about variables in the last 3 years or so. So that's maybe that's something you have to learn later in life if you've a certain personality, I don't know.
So I know that when I started to program was because of the magazines that you'd get that had like full page listings for things, and it was mostly games.
Well, that was the thing, I typed in loads of those. Just it's like learning things by rote, isn't it? I just typed it in literally from the magazine, never understood what I was typing, and sometimes got a game at the end of it. I could never debug it if I didn't. Just thought, oh no, I'll just buy a pre-compiled one.
Maybe that's what this generation needs, is someone doing like a blogging series of computer games for Scratch and with debugging instructions.
Well, I've got two books for Oscar today from the library. One was about coding for beginners using Scratch, and the other one was like a programming book, a coding book, which had like flaps, and it was really good. It showed you why you would use a variable, and it's got lift up flaps, and it's kind of really explains it really well.
Is that in the context of Scratch?
No, it's not. It's not. It's just like programming and coding, and that's it.
So, I mean, does it use like, is the example code, is it like a particular language?
No, it's not. It's just about programming in like a high level.
So maybe like what they call pseudo code, which is,
yeah,
kind of a language that shows you how the language works.
Maybe these are things we can stick into the show notes and again, see if anyone's got any suggestions about other things we could be looking at. Because obviously, from the sounds of things, Al and I have got very similar age children. And Jerry, yours are a little bit older.
Mine's older, yeah. And definitely not that they've gone past the age of... Well, actually, they did show a bit of interest in IT, kind of how computers work when they were younger. But then it was very much... computers turned into iPads and phones, and they just kind of went that way. But I think there is still something to be said about stitching APIs together, and, you know, that kids might do with different services to kind of...
If this, then that.
Yeah, yeah, that kind of thing.
Jerry, you're going to talk about what you've been doing or...
Yeah, well, I mean, I started a new contract a couple of weeks ago, as we record this, and I don't want to mention too much about it in case they were supposed to make me sign an NDA and they haven't got around to it yet. But anyway, the thing that I have been working on for the last couple of weeks mainly is making a boot CD, which is quite an old school thing to do in well, as far as I'm concerned, cause the last couple of years I've been using AWS and cloud providers and things, and they basically provide you with an OS image to then go and configure and do what you want to do with that and make it available to someone in a useful way. But as far as the sort of low level stuff, I haven't done that for quite a while. So this in particular, I'm looking to build a boot CD to install Ubuntu on a bit of hardware. So I developed this system using VMware and KVM particularly, which again is something I haven't used for a while, and working with Debian pre-seeding. So this is basically a system which, when you install Debian, if you use the old school Debian installer, it asks you a load of questions, and it's about providing the answers to those questions at install time. And this is, you do this using a text file. So that's basically what I've been doing for the last couple of weeks. Surprise, I built the text file using Ansible, because you can insert variables into it quite easily. And I used Docker to spin up something to take an Ubuntu ISO, turn it into a normal thing on the file system, inject the files that I've templated using Ansible, and then turn it back into an ISO and either give that straight to KVM to boot or turn it into a USB key to stick into a physical machine and boot that. So that's something that I haven't done for a while. Something I don't know if you guys have used anything like that.
Not exactly the same. So I think I've mentioned before that I use Ansible to bootstrap cloud instances, and then I inject stuff into the user data file. So it's not exactly the same way of doing things, but it's approaching from at least a slightly similar perspective. It sounds like you're dropping into the process much, much earlier than I am.
Yeah, well, it's to get physical hardware up, you kind of have to do that. And the way that this company working, at least for the moment, is they've got these basically hardware boxes that they're sending out, and they've got to get an OS on there, and they've got to get it configured. So they're using the stuff that I'm doing is used to get the basic OS on there, and then they're using Ansible once the OS is up to do that configuration. But it's still very early days. They're a startup, so they're just developing this thing and trying to get stuff out the door, basically, in a timely manner.
What do you mean by pre-seeding?
So as I was saying, it's answering the questions you get asked during an install. It's like, how do you want to partition the disk? Do you want to create any users? What's the root password?
An answer file, basically.
Yeah. But it's fairly badly documented by the Debian project and how you do this. I've used Red Hat /CentOS Kickstarter in the past, and that seems to be a lot better thought out in some ways. It's like, if you do an install on CentOS, a manual install, in the /root at the end of it, you get a file called anaconda-ks.cfg, and that gives you basically a file which you can then use to produce more installs of the same thing. Debian doesn't do that. You basically have to pick through this file and select, you know, cut the bits out that you need and put them into a text file. And it doesn't do the partitioning either. Like, so if you were to do an Anaconda install, a Red Hat Fedora install, and do the partitioning and so on, it would then give you, in the anaconda-ks.cfg, it will give you the partitioning setup as well. Debian doesn't do that.
Why not raise a bug for it? Why not raise a bug and say, you know, please can Debian provide the same infrastructure or same system as Red Hat does.
I'm scared that they'd ask me to do it. Not scared. Maybe not scared. But
do you know what? I don't think it would hurt.
My feeling is that people are using cloud providers, so they get that basic image. But I think more and more people, as time goes on, might want to get a bit more into the lower level stuff. So maybe it might be a good thing. The other thing that I briefly looked at was MaaS on Ubuntu, Metal as a Service, and that's for Pixie booting and getting you that first basic OS. This company didn't want to go that way because they just want to be able to create an ISO and
ship a box to site with the ISO attached.
Yeah, or even just ship a USB key to site and plug it in and have it working. So maybe not have that. To go a bit more into detail, MaaS is Pixie boot based. So you've got to have a DHCP server on site with the correct configuration, and then plug it into the network. Your hardware has to be Pixie bootable. So there's all that to take into account before you can start using that, really.
So have you tried using Pixie boot? I can't remember whether it was this. Was it the last one we discussed Pixie booting stuff? Can't remember now. It's quite a while between recordings. So.
I mean, just briefly, if we haven't, then it's just booting something off the network and giving it some initial information to be able to boot itself, and usually boot into like this pre-install environment where you can then install the OS, reboot from that, and you get a working machine. So this is probably something that something like AWS or Google Cloud or Azure will do in the background.
It's absolutely what they do in the background.
And it's all very proprietary, which is interesting.
Not so much, actually. So as I understand it, they're all basically using, particularly the Metal as a Service things that you can get, and the same in OpenStack as well. They all basically just run a standard DHCP server, and they use Pixie booting, PXE booting for pretty much everything they deploy. So even if it's not for the IAAS kind of environments, for their hosting platform is all Pixie booted up. The machines are largely based on having the pre-seed environment to bring them up. And then they'll then use things like the user data services that they have for their IAAS platforms, their infrastructure service platforms. They'll use the same services to provision their machines as they come up. It's not something I've looked tremendously deeply at, but there's definitely a lot of PXE based stuff in there.
Be interesting to know how OpenStack do it. It's probably how other cloud providers are doing it. A lot of them are based around just so you get a stock image, like an Ubuntu image or a CentOS image or whatever, and then you can you change that using the user data. That's how that's done is quite interesting. It could be different in OpenStack versus Azure versus AWS.
So the project name for the OpenStack side of things is called Ironic, IRON for iron, onic, because, ironic. But yeah, so that's the project. If you want to go and have a sort of poke around, I think that's the one that you're looking at.
I like their naming. It's like Cinder. Is there block storage, like Cinder block?
You mentioned Ansible before about the thing that you're working on. You mentioned something about callbacks.
Oh, yeah.
I just thought I'd call back to that for you.
Okay, yeah. Thanks for that. So I don't know if everyone is aware of this, but the latest version of Ansible, I think we talked a bit about this last time to do with the looping and so on. They've also, but I think by default now, there's the YAML callback plugin. So what is this? So if anyone here has run Ansible, anyone listening has run Ansible as well, you get this output, which is seems a bit garbled from your commands. So if something fails or succeeds, you might get something that you can just about read. You can make out some text strings and so on, but it's a bit confusing if you've never come across unformatted JSON before using the Ansible callback plugin. And you can do this by basically putting a couple of lines in your ansible.cfg. I'll stick some links in the show notes about this. So it basically gives the output in YAML, which is much more readable than JSON without any proper new lines in it. So if you say you're debugging a variable, a more complex variable, you can see what might not be working in there. You can read the outputs of commands that failed and so on much more easily. So I just thought I'd mention that, because if you put that in your Ansible.cfg, you're learning how to use Ansible, that might make it a lot easier to understand.
I would mention something else. I was mentioned on the Telegram group about the that as I migrated my VPS from my old server to my new server, the certificates, which I use Let's Encrypt, as I moved, there was no easy way of moving the whole configuration of the from one box to the other, because I was going from FreeBSD to Ubuntu. So I basically, because obviously what it does, it generates the keys for you, so the private and the public keys. So I basically manually moved those across from the old server to the new server, just I could basically point them to me, it just worked. But one of them was expiring, and I was a bit worried about how I was going to get it to, how it was going to work. So I installed CertBot, which I had to have my old box, but it was a very old version. I was very impressed. Within like under 2 minutes, I had my certificates on there, not just my existing certificates, but my other two servers I had on there, and it updated the anything as well. So if it's like www.admin-admin-podcast, it also did www.admin-admin-podcast, and it also did the redirection for you. So it redirected you from HTTP to HTTPS for you within like 2 minutes of setting it up. So I was really impressed with just installing CertBot and how quickly it managed to get all it working.
I should take another look. It's been a while since I used Let's Encrypt, or tried to use it. Anyway, I think the certs on my personal server have run out a while ago, so I'll have to check that out.
It's really good.
CertBot I found very helpful. I mean, so particularly in the work that I did with lug.org.uk, we've got a handful of lugs that are on there. And actually to create certificates for all of those is actually really straightforward. So yeah, CertBot is definitely going from strength to strength. So I'd definitely recommend, if you haven't already sort of started using CertBot and you're using Let's Encrypt, there's some other ones as well. There's I think acme.sh, which is just a shell script to do certificate management rather than CertBot, which is Python based. But yeah, there's a few different Let's Encrypt scripts that are really quite strong.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's going to basically auto-update itself, or when it regenerates certificates resigns every 3 months. I'd like to see how that works without doing it manually this time. But I think it does it all for you now. You set it up properly. I think it sets all up the cron jobs for you.
Yeah, absolutely does.
I mean, just as an aside, I've seen quite a few organizations using Let's Encrypt. Just, I think, probably not in production, but using it on all their non-production environments. And it works really well. I think people have yet to make the jump to production, but I don't see why it couldn't be used in production, as long as there's something you have to keep on top of, obviously.
I was quite interested if anyone's actually managed to do it on Windows yet with IIS, or if there's a cert bot for Windows.
You could use the certs themselves on Windows, I suppose, just not actually run. Well, you could run it in VM or something, couldn't you, I suppose? Or use Ansible. I mean, I was playing with Ansible, you know, the OpenSSL. You can use it to generate CSR and generate certificates and things, so maybe that might be a thing with Windows.
We'll have to have a poke around. So the last thing really to mention this in this show is obviously I might have plugged once or twice up till now some of the events that were forthcoming. The ones that we have been plugging up till now have all passed, or will have passed between when we're recording this and when it gets put out on the feed. But the last one is OgCamp, which obviously I'm one of the organisers for. So I thought I'd. Seeing as all the other things we normally mention have all gone away, I'd spend a couple of minutes just talking about OddCamp and where we're up to. Partially as we've had a little bit of a development since the last show was recorded, which is that an organisation called Dot Everyone have actually given OddCamp a Fairer Tech grant, basically giving us some funding to be able to make the event more welcoming and inviting, and to make the event more diverse. One of the things that we've done with that grant money is actually we've spoken to our friends over at the Raspberry Pi Foundation, and they have I can't remember exactly what the business relationship is, but I think the Raspberry Pi Foundation is either an owner or part owner of the Coda Dojo organization.
Oh, right.
And so we are on track at the moment to have a Coda Dojo at OddCamp 2018. And essentially that's going to take the form of a room at OddCamp, which will have at least one educator, but maybe a couple of people in there to help younger people. And by that, I mean, if you wouldn't normally attend an OddCamp because you'd want to be doing something else, but you might be interested in learning Python or Scratch or something like that, then you can get a younger person ticket. They're still free, so OddCamp is obviously a pay what you want from free event. The younger person ticket is a free ticket as well, with the intention being that you would use that ticket to attend the Coda Dojo session. And we're still hammering out exactly what the details look like, but we are hoping that we'll have a session probably either at the end of the first day or at the end of the second day, where you actually get to show off what you've done in the Coda Dojo in one of the unconf sessions. So we're still, as I said, we're still hammering out exactly what those details look like, but that's what we're hoping, fingers crossed, will be happening at OddCamp. So if you know somebody who is a younger person, or if you're responsible for a younger person, you're thinking of coming to OddCamp, but you might have been put off by the fact that you couldn't bring a child with you, or you know, you weren't sure about exactly, you know, what they'd have to do there whilst you were there, or if you were only going to attend one day because, you know, you couldn't have childcare or something like that, and please revisit that idea, because OddCamp is definitely looking for younger people to come along and do stuff.
I should add that the other odd camps that I've been to, there have been kids there, even if they weren't specifically catered for. It has been quite a sort of kid-heavy event. It's just people taking their kids there because they're into things and they think their kids might be. So if you haven't done that before, think about it this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we've always prided ourselves on being
inclusive.
One of the downsides to the IT field is that it does tend to favour, you know, the white CIS male sort of stereotype. And obviously OddCamp was founded by two podcasts, one of whom had, you know, a female member in the podcast. So, you know, we set out from very early on to try to be quite inclusive, partially because we were coming from a position of having inclusivity from the founding groups of people. We've tried to make that more apparent as we've gone through, and particularly since I've taken on the reins, you know, I've brought in more stuff to make it more inclusive. And that's not to say anyone before me wasn't trying to be inclusive, because they were, but, you know, I've been actively looking to try and improve our inclusivity. And this is just another step on that road towards making it more inclusive. OddCamp obviously is on the 18th and 19th of August. It's in Sheffield. Tickets are available from oddcamp.org. That's oggcamp.org. And as I said, they're pay what you want from free. We're organising at the moment the social side of things for the evenings. So we try and meet up at an informal meeting on the Friday night and on the Sunday night, so before the first day and after the second day, and then have a formal evening do on the Saturday night. We're still exactly trying to figure out where we're going for those. We've had a call for papers this year, so between now, when the recording, we're doing the recording for this show, and when the show goes out, we should have the names of the scheduled track.
I actually looked at that just now. I've actually just submitted one.
Excellent.
On air.
Oh, okay. Even better.
You heard it here first.
Fantastic. I look forward to putting that one to the bottom. I mean, to giving that the due notice. So Odd Camp has three stages, one of which has a scheduled track on it, and the other two are unconference tracks, plus this Coda Dojo in a fourth room. So we're hoping, as I said before, this show goes into the feed, to actually have the scheduled track planned out and ready to go. So if you take a look and see if there's any of those talks that you're interested in seeing, and if none of the talks there particularly appeal to you, still consider coming along to Odd Camp anyway, because it is an unconference. If you want to talk about something you've not known about the call for papers, it was introduced rather late on in the process, but if you want to talk about something, please bring your talk along. And there's usually at least a few slots that open up on the unconference board, and we'll try and make sure that your talk gets seen by people at the event.
I think that's the best thing about Odd Camp is the unconference bit. I mean, I like just going listen to people like Stuart Langridge and stuff. People like that is just so good listening to, and even people you don't know.
I think the thing to emphasise is do a talk and take it along, even if you may not do it. You probably will get an opportunity to do it, or at least think about doing it.
Try not to wing it. Say, for example, if you were talking to somebody drunk in the bar the night before and commit to doing a talk that you know enough about to speak in a bar about, but don't know enough to actually stand up in front of a room full of people.
And someone who knows about someone who in that talk who knew a lot more about it.
I think my personal advice is do a slide deck, even if you don't use it.
He did. You did it. Someone did do.
Oh, right.
Yeah. Yes, I may or may not have written a slide deck drunk and then tried to deliver it on the following day. But, I mean, either way, you know, the good thing about any unconference, whether you come to Odd Camp or any other unconference, there's loads of them coming up. And they're all over the country. They're all over the world. If you're going to a conference that has got an unconference track, take a talk with you. As Jerry said, even if you don't end up delivering it, it's a great opportunity to see whether the content you've got is something that might fit that audience. So take a look at the board. And even if there's nothing that screams out the subject you're talking about there, the chances are, if you put it up on the board, someone's going to come and listen to it.
Well, my talk last year, we had nothing to do about open source. It was about mental health and IT.
Anything that you can think of talking about that do you think might be relevant to the kind of general theme?
To the theme, yeah.
Of the conference / unconference is fair game, basically. So give it a go. Get out there and do it, and let people know how your mind works and what you're thinking, basically. That's what it comes down to. Or just talk about some tech that you like.
Yep. All good. All good things.
That's just a couple of things you could talk about.
So I think it's probably worth starting to try and wrap things up, because we've gone on for about an hour. So first thing to mention in this wrap-up is that the wonderful, amazing and talented Dave Lee from the Bugcast, as always, reviews our shoddy audio recordings and waves his magic wand and fixes us up so that we sound like we're at least vaguely close to being professional at this stuff. So thank you very much, as always, to Dave Lee. He's a scholar and a gentleman, and if you are coming to Odd Camp, you might even potentially see him there. Is there anything else we need to mention before we wrap up the show this week?
I don't think so. Our links to like our Telegram site are on the on our website, abnabinpodcast.co.uk, and all our social media links. So thanks for listening, guys and girls.
Until the next time.
Cheers. Bye.
See you later.